You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
What do you know?
Never gonna know, never gonna know.
Whoa. Thank you again, dear listener, for downloading yet another Dear Science Podcast. I am Jonathan Golub, the science columnist at The Stranger, and this is my semi-weekly, irregular podcast edition of my column. I'd like to thank Big Little Dipper Dipper for the theme music. Today we're going to talk about nuclear power, and joining me is Jonah Spangenthal Lee with even a Jewier name than I have. I'm very proud of you for
this. It's amazing. Thank you.
I feel like, you know, two Jews talking about nuclear power, we seem somewhat authoritative on this matter. And we'll try to not frighten the tech-savvy youth at any point here.
Right.
Jonah's a news reporter at The Stranger, and you should check out his stuff about, particularly, I'm following his reporting on the police. It's been good enough that he probably fears for his life if he ever actually has to call 911, which is
exactly why I'm here to talk about nuclear power.
Exactly. So we should probably dump right into it. So I wrote a long series of posts on nuclear power at my blog, dearscience.org, and I also linked to it off of Slog. You can search for either and read up on it. So what do you think, Jonah?
I'm still frightened by it. I read your posts. There were a lot of analogies to pool tables and you know, explaining how this is all going to be safe in the future by 2030, I believe it was.
Yes. That was the big delay. There's these new generation of reactors that were worked on in the late 80s and early 90s, and then the budget was cut. And so they're just now sort of re-dragging it up.
Oh, right. Yeah, I came down with a really bad case of China syndrome then.
So we should talk. We should talk a little bit about, like, what nuclear power actually is. I think this is one of those things where everyone has a really strong opinion about it and knows, like, jack shit about what actually goes on.
I know jack shit about it, and I'm pretty ambivalent, if that helps. So
this is kind of where I am. I think I know a fair bit, and I'm pretty ambivalent. And I think that's, like, the reasonable end point to be at. Nuclear power basically gets all of its energy from changing an atom to a different kind of atom. And this all gets around the fact that every atom in the universe secretly wishes to become iron, which is sort of a strange thing to imagine.
I've always wanted to be Iron Man.
So this is – and there's a physical basis for this this whole desire here. So, like, big atoms tend to be miserable, and if you break them into pieces, they release a bunch of energy and they're happier. Likewise, small atoms, if you combine them together, tend to be a little bit happier. And in the 1930s and 40s, we got really good at breaking up atoms, usually to blow stuff up and kill Japanese. We sort of move beyond that at this point, I'd like to think. The Japanese have gone to killing themselves with radiation as opposed to us. But and so there's a handful of atoms in the universe that really are miserable and tend to break up in a somewhat spectacular fashion. So we're talking sort of things like uranium or plutonium.
Sort of emo atoms.
Exactly. Right. And so, like, you take these big, unhappy emo atoms. The metaphor I used in my column was almost like an emo party. You have a big, unruly party of people who are just really not all that happy to be together. And you add one more miserable, whiny person to it, and then it splinters into two big pieces and flings off a couple of miserable, screaming people. And so the whole idea of, like, a nuclear reactor is you have these atoms, you know about them, and you know these miserable screaming people that are flung out after you break up one of these can go and break up another one. So you put enough of these big, unhappy atoms next to one another, and you can build a chain reaction where the flying out neutron, the screaming unhappy person from one atom can break up the next one and the next one and the next one. So if you do this out with no control, you have a nuclear bomb. And you destroy, you know, the Ruskies or something. But if you kind of have it
destroy somebody,
yeah, exactly. You got to nuke something, as they say.
Exactly.
If you have it under control, where there's just enough that it's kind of like there's not more atom running out of control, you can actually do it. You can actually harness this to boil water, basically. Boil water eventually to run a turbine and make electricity. And so this has been going on since the 50s. This is sort of like the whole thing where they're like, we built the bomb, and we needed, like, some cover story why we keep doing this. We're like, you know, won the war, built the bomb, and they're like, atoms for peace. We're going to make everyone wonderful. And the frightening thing to imagine is that almost every nuclear reactor that's built and operating or is proposed to being built right now for nuclear power, like commercial nuclear power, is basically an unchanged design since the 1950s.
Isn't that, like, basically what's happened with dentistry, too? Like, it hasn't changed in 50 years?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The drugs are a little bit better.
Aren't they always?
But they always are.
Well,
which throws back to last week's podcast. But I don't know. So I mean, this is one of the things. And so, I don't know. Does that make sense to you? Like, would you buy like that?
Would I buy a nuclear reactor?
I mean, like, so this is, it's sort of a crazy way to do it. I mean, the way I always think about nuclear power is it's the one sort of source of energy that people have available that is not in some way based on the sun.
Well, let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. Right now, big discussion going on. What's worse for me? Clean coal, nuclear power.
Oh. I'm not a
50
big,
words or less.
50 words or less.
You don't really have to do 50 words or less.
I mean, I think clean coal is worse for you as a person than nuclear power, because most of the good coal, what clean coal means is that the idea that, you know, you scrub it and you kind of clean off the things, and then and the ultimate dream of a clean coal sort of power plant is you take all the carbon that's coming out of the smokestacks and you like compress it into a liquid, or you put like infuse it into rock deep underground so that there's no carbon emissions even from running a coal plant. Then you take all of the ash that's burnt up and you bury it somewhere and all his life is wonderful. Then you can have a coal power plant that's working forever and ever and ever, and doesn't release carbon and doesn't release really any emissions, and we all live glorious life thanks to the great amount of coal. And part of the reason why I think people are very excited about this is there's a huge amount of coal available. In the United States is the Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Iraq of coal combined. And so if you're willing to like strip the entire middle part of the country, and what really is the middle part of the country doing for us right now?
That's what I
from like West Virginia to Montana, just sort of take off all of the soil, dig out the coal, and then put the soil back down. Boom. And maybe not put the soil back down. But the problem with coal, the thing about it is coal in and of itself isn't radioactive, but a lot of the stuff that it's with, that is sort of in with it, is radioactive. And this carbon sequestration, this idea of taking all the carbon and like liquefying it or burying it somewhere, is really more of an idea right now. Like, I'm generally in favor of developing technologies because I like having lots of tools available in the toolbox. But I don't think this is the greatest solution. I think a lot of countries are doing it. I mean, like, the Chinese economy is pretty much powered right now by burning old tires. And so in some senses, like, coal might be a step up from that, but not a big step up.
You
got to
do something with those old tires.
And so that's one of the sort of crazy irrational things. You think about the Three Mile accident, which is the worst accident of a commercial power plant of the design that are built in the United States. We can talk about Chernobyl, and we're definitely going to talk about Chernobyl.
Good.
Chernobyl is like its own special thing, and I think a Chernobyl-style accident is unlikely to happen outside of that kind of reactor, which are still operating.
Where?
In Romania and some of the former Soviet satellite states. The Russians were so frightened of this reactor, they didn't actually build it in Russia. They built it we'll put it in like Ukraine or Belarus or Romania. And so I think there's a few of these remaining in operation in Romania. But Three Mile, you can think about Three Mile and about your worst case scenario. They basically fucked up every way they could possibly fuck up to get the reactor to go badly. And I guess this is as good a time as any we can talk about. We have to talk a little bit about how a reactor, and I'll do this in like, again, as short as I can. You should read the post. It's going to be a lot easier to follow.
There's pictures too.
There are pictures. So we're trying to do this chain reaction. We need a couple things to make it hold together. So first thing, obviously, you need some coolant. You're making a lot of heat. You have to take some way to get the heat away. And water is about perfect for this, at least back when you think about the 1950s. It holds a lot of heat. It can be turned into steam. So usually what you end up is having two cycles. You have water that's pumped through the actual reactor right next to all these uranium or plutonium rods where the fissioning is actually happening. And then that water is pumped out, and the heat is transferred from that water to a second loop of water. And that way you keep – and if the water even gets a little bit radioactive, you keep it separate. And then that water – the second batch of water flashes to steam. You know, you pump it out of a river, flash it to steam, run a turbine, and then cool it and cycle it back over again. And this is why power plants tend to be next to rivers or oceans or lakes or something, some source of water. But that first loop of water, because water does boil at a fairly low temperature, you put it under pressure, and then the boiling point of water goes way up. So it's this pressurized water that's constantly recycled and the heat's drawn away from it. Okay. You have your coolant. Then you need some way of controlling, right? So I said the neutrons go determine how many new free neutrons you have that hit the next molecule, the next atom, determine how vigorous your nuclear reaction is going. You have too many neutrons running around, it explodes, right? That's a bomb.
That's bad.
That's bad.
Okay.
Good safety tip, Egon. Right. So you go through and you have control rods, which is basically anything, any material that absorbs neutrons like mad.
And what are they generally used for those?
just boron, borated carbon, things like that that just suck them up.
Boring old boron.
Yeah. So, yeah, inanimate carbon rod, you know, like from The Simpsons. Okay,
exactly.
A lot of Simpsons. Right. Jonah kind of inspires me for this. So you have your control rods that absorb neutrons, and you stick them in, and you gobble them up, and the chain reaction stops, and everything is disco. But you can have some problems with this all around. Now, the other thing you have to deal with is it's actually kind of tricky. You need really – in the uranium and plutonium, they're coming – plutonium is an artificial. We have to make plutonium. It doesn't really exist in nature. So we actually manufacture it. We make it in nuclear reactors.
Where do we make that?
You can make it from uranium, uranium by radiation, radioactive mutation of the atom.
So like if I put plutonium in my microwave?
No. Microwave won't do it. But if you take unenriched uranium next to enriched uranium, then you can do it. And so what I mean by enriched and unenriched uranium is like most things in most atoms have a couple different versions. Some are more common than others. So uranium has two different versions, three different versions, but two really are the ones we care about. 238, which is the overwhelming bulk of it, and it's actually kind of shitty. It doesn't release all that – and it'll fission, but it doesn't release all that many neutrons, so it's really hard to build a chain reaction with it. You need to save every neutron that flies out of it.
What's a neutron?
Okay. High school chemistry. All right. So like – atoms. You can think about atoms are made out of three pieces, right? You have this cloud of electrons flying around the outside, which are negatively charged and we're going to ignore because that's chemists and we're not chemists right now. Screw them. Chemists can't do anything interesting. And then you got the actual nucleus of the atom, which is all the heavy stuff. And the nucleus is comprised basically of two different kinds of, like, you almost think about them like pool balls. You have protons, which are positively charged. And neutrons, which are negatively charged, are neutral charged. They have no charge. So you remember also from like high school chemistry class, like positive things.
I failed science like 8 times.
Okay, well, we're going to do it here. So like positively charged things hate being next to one another, right? Like really, really hate. It's almost impossible to put them together. But when you get these protons and neutrons really, really, really close together, they actually suck in and will hold to one another. But if you even separate them a little bit, the electrostatic forces, the positive next to positive, tends to fling it apart. And that's kind of why iron is that bright balance where there's enough protons and neutrons together in the right ratio that the atom actually holds together fairly cheerfully. If you have two, just like you imagine, like a helium, it's only two protons and two neutrons. It's actually kind of miserable. Everyone wants to get a little bit bigger to do it. And likewise, uranium, you have 92 protons all trying to get along with one another. And
you just pulled that out of there, 92?
I paid attention in high school science class.
Busy getting high. I'm
I had some people in my chemistry class I studied with who were busy getting high, and they were always kind of good at the nuclear physics. So we're gonna, so please start smoking now, and the rest of this podcast will make way more sense to you. This is not true, right? So like, all right, so that's proton and neutron. So you think about protons can also break up other atoms, right? They can act like the neutrons do, like sort of like think about it like a cue ball trying to break up a set of these pool balls. But the problem is it's positively charged. As it gets close to the atom, another atom with all these positive charges, it veers off and gets deflected away. The neutron, because it has no charge, can get really, really – it just keeps going in a straight line and hits right into it. And so that's why when I say like it breaks up and you fling off a couple neutrons, these neutrons are like the perfect cue balls to keep the chain reaction going and break the next set of atoms up into smaller pieces.
Okay.
So uranium-238 doesn't release all that many neutrons when it breaks up, and so you need to save every one of them to build a chain reaction. In other words, you have to be like really efficient with it. Uranium-235, however, releases many more neutrons when it breaks up, and so you can actually lose a lot of them. They go flying out of the reactor before they even hit another uranium atom. And so who cares? It doesn't matter. You have enough remaining behind. So the other way we can keep more neutrons around is bouncing them off of something.
So we want to keep neutrons around.
If you have something like uranium-238, you have to because you need every neutron you got or close to it. So you need something you can bounce neutrons off of. And one thing you can bounce neutrons off of is water. So this is when I said like it's like bumper pool, right? That kind of bounces, and it keeps it on the pool table rather than flying off the pool table. So it has a good chance of hitting another uranium atom and blasting it to pieces. So it gets kind of nifty. This is kind of a nifty idea, and you can almost get how when they were designing these reactors came up with the idea. Well, if we only slightly enrich for – we have mostly still uranium-238 and a little bit of 235, and then we add some water into the reactor, then we can get our keeper chain reaction going. And that's kind of cool because water's our coolant. So if we lose our coolant, like the reactor cracks and breaks and all of the water flashes to steam, we lose our moderator and the chain reaction stops. And so it's sort of an intrinsic safety feature of that kind of reactor because, well – you know, it may – there'll be some residual heat and you can get some melting and things like that. But it's not like you're going to like have the reaction – the nuclear reaction run out of control and become like a nuclear bomb or so, like a dirty bomb.
So by using water instead of like maple syrup, we're safer.
Exactly. Okay. Or graphite, which is a kind of carbon. Carbon will do – graphite will do a beautiful job of moderating. And so – and this is the Chernobyl disaster. Right? So think about it. You either have to have – if you're going to build our chain reaction – because regular water – water, again, comes into a couple different variants. I wrote a column on this, heavy water versus regular water, which you should check out, which will help explain it. Heavy water already has some neutrons already attached to it. And so the neutrons are more likely to bounce off heavy water than get stuck on the heavy water. And so if you have very, very few neutrons, you have mostly uranium-238, if you enrich the water for the heavy water that already has neutrons stuck on it, then you can get away with it. If you only want to use light water, you have to enrich more for uranium. And the Russians, you can almost see this. This is like in the 50s. And the Russians have, you know, every scrap of enriched uranium, all the uranium-235 is going to build bombs. They have no heavy water. And there's some, you know, you can almost hear like the engineers are like, we need a reactor now. Because we have to keep up. Remember, reactors, you can make plutonium in a reactor to make bombs. Like, we want a plutonium-producing reactor now. And we're not giving you anything you need. And so you can see like nuclear engineering mean, well, if I take out the water and replace it with graphite as a moderator, then I don't need – I can use regular old water. I can actually take the waste uranium. The uranium is actually – it has more 238. All the 235 has been stripped out of it. Use that for a fuel. And then we can get a reactor. And they're like and it's ridiculous. It's incredibly dangerous. What happens? The reactor breaks and you run out of coolant water. And remember, the regular water actually absorbs a couple neutrons. So now you've actually added even more neutrons into the situation. And you have the graphite to keep them around. And you now have uncooled rods. And then to add the last little treat on all of this, graphite explodes when it gets hot enough. And so you've basically – that reactor, when it fails, is like a gigantic dirty bomb. Awesome. Everyone's sweet out of control. And because you have to use quite a bit of graphite to build this, it's so big you can't build a big, heavy concrete dome over it. So every reactor in the United States, which has water as a coolant and moderator, is in a big, heavy concrete building because you can build a reactor that's relatively small because you're using enriched fuel and a few other things. The Chernobyl reactor design doesn't use water as a moderator. It uses the graphite. So what happens when it fails? And it's too big to fit in a building. So what happens when the coolant runs out? Well, it explodes. And it's like the world's most gigantic dirty bomb. Way dirtier than an atomic bomb would be because in an atomic bomb, at least most of the radioactive stuff gets used up to make the explosion. This one, it's like accidental. So you have this horrible, unstable design that's basically to try to be cheap and avoid having to do all this preparatory work. It's not in a containment building, and then you add on to the fact that the people running the plant are like conscripts from coal plants around the Soviet Union who basically were the fuck-ups who got sent to work at the plant in, you know, Ukraine. Who the hell wants to work in Ukraine? And so like – and then to add a little better. So these – one of the things that goes on in these older style reactors is as the fuel gets used up, as the fissioning goes on, like I say – fissioning makes new atoms, and these atoms tend to absorb up neutrons. So as you use your fuel up, over time you have to pull your control rods more and more out because the fuel itself starts building up these neutron-absorbing, poisoning things. So they're incredibly – the fuel actually gets more radioactive but not in the way we need it to be. And so what you have to do is you have to – every so often you have to stop the reactor, pull out the fuel rods, break them up chemically, strip out all of these incredibly radioactive but neutron-gobbling atoms, rebuild the fuel rods, and put them back in the reactor. So every couple years you have to go through this rigmarole.
See, you're making meltdowns sound like such a bad thing. I mean, you know, without meltdowns, without, you know, explosions, whatever, we wouldn't have Spider-Man.
No,
wouldn't have the Hulk.
The Hulk who's coming out this weekend.
Hey, exactly. He's big and he's green and he's mean. And there's some, who else? I'm forgetting somebody. But the X-Men, perhaps. X-Men. So what, you know, let's say meltdown happens. Let's say there's a spider hanging out. It doesn't die and then it bites me. Do I get superpowers?
No.
Why not?
No. So let's talk about, you know, this is fun. This will make you cry. Do you know what happened, what the radiation does to the body in 300 words or less? At the lowest doses of radiation, it kills all your blood-producing cells, and you die of anemia. You basically die of an AIDS-like illness because you stop having white blood cells and you start dying all these kind of beautiful, flagrant infections. If you get a little bit more radiation from that, then you die because the cells in your gut stop being able to make more copies of themselves. And so you die when your gut thins and all the bacteria living in your gut get inside of you and eat you alive. At a yet higher dose of radiation, you go up a little bit more. Then you start getting things where the radiation actually starts killing cells directly. So usually it's the brain cells because the brain's in like an enclosed cavity. So brain cells die and start to swell, and then you die of brain failure. And then the highest dose, you literally get blasted with so many little microscopic nanoscale holes from all these neutrons and protons and everything flying out of the radiation that you just die.
You are such a fucking bummer. Thank you for ruining all of my childhood aspirations to be a superhero.
You started smoking. Now this is the time to put away sharp objects and, you know, like, out of the whole thing. So there is some so radiation, it should be you should take it seriously. But the other way to think about radiation is that takes a lot of radiation to even get to that lowest level of being irradiated where you don't have blood cells anymore. In fact, our bodies are really good about dealing with radiation because we're always exposed to it. The sun has a ton of radiation. Water is radioactive. Everything we eat is radioactive.
That's what makes it tasty, though.
Exactly. So, like, we can actually handle it. So in some ways, radiation is less of a concern to me than, like, new poisonous chemicals because that we may not ever have seen, whereas our bodies actually have a fairly ornate and well-developed system to deal with radiation. This goes back to your way, way earlier question. You gave me 50 words, and I've gone on to probably 20,000.
Sorry.
Coal versus nuclear. Coal releases radiation, and because the radioactive compounds in it. And you have all this ash, right? You burn, just like you burn something in your fireplace. All this ash. The ash is radioactive. You have to bury that somewhere too. It's not tremendously radioactive, but it gets into your lungs and it gets everywhere. And so it's sort of a weird dichotomy. People worry about radiation from a nuclear power plant. More radiation is typically released from a coal plant in a year than was released during the whole Three Mile accident. Because Three Mile accident was a reactor with water as a moderator and a coolant. The second coolant loop, the one that's like non-radioactive outside the reactor, the pumps for that failed. The water heated up in the first loop, and there no more heat could be pumped out of the first loop because the second loop had broken down. And then the water flashed the steam in the first loop. It got hot enough. The reaction stopped because the moderator went away, and it melted because of a little bit of heat, and that was it. And they had to clean it up, and it was a pain in the ass, but almost all the radiation was contained within the heavy concrete building. And that will happen again. That will happen again. With the current the kind of reactors we have operating and continue to operate and that are planning to build worldwide, that will happen again.
So,
and that isn't all that damn bad. In my mind, if we're being rational about it, I'm not worried about Three Mile Islands happening every 20, 30, 40 years, one of those happening every 20, 30, 40 years.
I wasn't until you told me I couldn't get spider powers.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Jonah.
All right. What are these new designs? What's new and fancy and different?
It's kind of a nifty thing, right? Because most of these earlier designs, you can kind of get a sense that everyone's trying to be cheap, right? You don't have a lot of enriched uranium. You don't have a lot of plutonium. You don't have a lot of heavy water. And so you're trying to make do with sort of relatively crappy starting ingredients. But the Cold War ended, right?
And we have... Really?
Yeah. Oh. So I've heard.
I didn't pay a lot of attention in school, so it's...
And so we have actually an excess amount of plutonium and uranium, enriched uranium, sitting around. And so if you're in that world where we have a ton of these radioactive atoms that we don't want to build more bombs, and we don't want to just have them sitting somewhere where someone could possibly steal them or use them to build their own bomb, well, hell, let's build a reactor where we don't have to worry about having to use a really good moderator. Right, where you have so many neutrons, either because you're using plutonium or highly enriched uranium as a fuel, you can get away with it. And then you can start doing some nifty things. You don't have to use water as a coolant or a moderator. You can use something like liquid metal as your coolant.
Like in Terminator 2?
Yeah, totally.
Man.
And so, or you can use a gas like helium as your coolant. And then you can start doing some really nifty design ideas off this. So one of them is a liquid lead cooled reactor. And so the idea of this one is you just have it a sealed vessel. And because you can – the fuel's a little bit better going in.
A nuclear vessel?
Yes. Oh, great. Ah, oh, Chekhov. Right. And so you have your sealed thing that's like a turnkey thing. And because you're using good enough fuel and you have a lot of neutrons, you don't care. It takes a lot longer for enough of these bad neutron-absorbing atoms to build up to totally stop the reactor. So you have this thing where it's completely sealed. You don't have to go and shut it down every couple years or so to pull out fuel rods and replace them. And so 15, 20 years. So the idea is you put this in somewhere, let it operate for 15 years, and then you pull it out as a whole thing and put in a new one. And you take it back to the plant and you reprocess it and cycle it over. And so in that sense, because you're not having to screw around with it as often, turn it on and turn it off and swap out fuel, there's a lot less chance for a disaster to happen. And then also the other second idea to make it safer is, so every plant in the United States is a little bit different because everyone was like bitted out and there's all these different parts. So everyone's a little bit more difficult to operate. The French, when they built their system, the French get about three quarters of their power from nuclear power. They had like three basic designs that just copied over and over again, and that made it, they've never had a disaster because there are quirks in every design, but then you learn them, and then a lesson learned in one plant is transferable to all of them of the same design. So this is like a country, either a remote area or a country that doesn't want to have to be processing fuel, or a place where it's like you just don't want to have to transport fuel for all these long distances every couple of years. You drop this in, and it's quite safe. And the other thing, it has something that's called passively safe, which that means is if the outside coolant, like in Three Mile Island, the problem was the second coolant loop failed and there was still so much heat trying to be transferred out of the first coolant loop, the first coolant loop blasted apart. All of the new designs are passively safe, and this, what that means is even if you have no secondary cooling, you just have the reactor and it's completely cut off from the world and it was operating and then suddenly all the outside cooling was lost, it can dissipate enough heat because metal conducts heat so well that it will not melt down and it'll just shut down. And the other thing they do is, you know, the fuel has to be very physically close to it. So you put the fuel in a matrix that expands as it gets hotter. And so if the reactor starts getting hot, this is again part of passive safety, it expands physically until the fuel rods are too far apart from one another to keep the chain reaction going. And so it's sort of like nuclear power for idiots. And that was kind of what did the Chernobyl plant, right? They were switching fuel and they decided to play like an experiment. They're like, I wonder what would happen if we turned off all the coolant pumps while we were switching the fuel out. I wonder what would happen if anything bad happened. And the answer was yes. All the water boiled off and it did the whole dirty bomb scenario. And then they had to send people in basically to shovel sand on flaming radioactive graphite and uranium trying to put the fire out, and the people would die from the last, like the thing I said, where there's literally so blasted the radiation, they were dropped dead within a couple minutes from most cells in their body exploding.
Awesome.
So that's bad. That's almost impossible to happen with the older designs, the newer designs. So I should keep going. So one of the other ones is helium-cooled design. Which can operate at very high temperatures because it's gas-cooled and it has some nice things. The one that I think is the dreamiest is actually liquid sodium metal-cooled. And the idea of this is to actually have several of these reactors at a plant where you can actually eat up the radioactive waste from other plants that have already been produced. It has so fission, produces so many neutrons that you can actually convert these waste atoms by binging them with enough neutrons into something that's useful, and then burn that off as fuel in this reactor, producing heat with it. And so the idea of this is you don't build a lot of these. You have a couple of these. Maybe you build them underground if you're worried about the safety. The wrinkle, of course, is that liquid sodium or sodium metal in general explodes when it comes in contact with water. Right? It's an explosive metal. And so this is the trade-off. There was actually a reactor like this built, a much older design, but a liquid sodium metal-cooled reactor built on the shore of Lake Erie right next to Detroit that melted down in the 1950s.
Is that why Detroit looks like that?
Yeah, exactly. There's a book, How We Almost Lost Detroit, and it's dreamy because of all the things. They still think that one of the theories is a crumpled beer can from the construction that blocked a coolant pipe that caused it to melt down. But it's notable that even in the sort of nightmare-y scenario of no real radiation was lost, so it's the Fermi 1 plant. And so they're not flawless, and I think it's worth researching them. I'm kind of a big fan of doing this. What I like about particularly the sodium-cooled, but even the lead-cooled and the helium-cooled, is that the biggest problem with nuclear power, I think, as it is now, I think a lot of people worry about disasters and meltdowns. And to my mind, like Three Mile Island's about as bad as it gets. And for as far as a reactor failing, I'm much more worried about all of the radioactive waste that's built up, right?
Now, what is... Is it just water that's all that's gone off?
No, it's not even water. Like I said, so you remember the res, you use the fuel rods, you build up, you make new atoms that are neutron absorbing and extremely radioactive. And you can strip them away chemically and reuse the good atoms, the uranium and plutonium, as a fuel. But you have all this stuff. What do you do with it? The good news is the most radioactive atoms burn themselves off in a relatively short amount of time. But there's enough even at mid-level and radioactive enough stuff that lasts for hundreds and hundreds, if not millions of years. And so no one really has a plan to do with it.
We're going
to
bury it under Nevada, right?
Yeah, but no one can really agree with that, right? The whole idea is you can't – nothing
we can agree
human
on
beings
it.
Can be build – can last for that length of time, particularly if it's being bombarded with radiation. So the whole idea is like you put buried in Nevada, and then it's when it's super radioactive, and then by the time it's all of the things you put it in, whether you embed it in glass or put it in concrete or whatever, by the time all of that's corroded and melted away, it'll only be mostly radioactive, not like hideously radioactive.
Right,
and then it'll be like a gigantic – it's Nevada. Again, who cares? What's the middle part of the country do to us anyway? But the truth of the matter is Nevada is always – everyone talks about Nevada. Most of the stuff ends up in Washington State. So, like, I think Washington State has the world's finest collection of radioactive severed heads and things like that that are just, you know, because Hanford, I mean, that is the go-to place to bury hideously radioactive stuff right now. And then as far as, like, the leftover fuel rods and that stuff, that is outside every nuclear power plant all over the country, sitting outside of the containment building, out of the heavy concrete building, and usually in little concrete bunkers that only are supposed to last for a couple decades, waiting for it to be picked up and shipped somewhere.
So there's just waste hanging out?
Everywhere. France, I think, paid India to take theirs. And it's just hanging out in, like, the ground, above ground. And everyone's waiting. They're like, ah, we'll figure something out. And it's been, you know, 60 years.
Can't we just shoot it into the sun or something?
Possibly.
See, I'm a scientist.
There's about 300,000 tons of it. And it costs about $1,000 a ton to put something in orbit. And if the rocket blows up, it would be kind of messy.
I'm not a mathematician, but it sounds feasible.
One of the things that people have talked about it, this is where one of the things I like about these new designs, like the sodium metal cooled reactor, it eats this. That's one of the things. You can bury it, or you can – remember, we can change atoms to different atoms. So let's change these atoms into something that's relatively innocuous, or something we can use as reactor fuel and
set
it up.
It's like composting your nuclear waste.
Exactly. That's actually a really good metaphor. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, it's like compost – it's like your compost pile for your nuclear waste.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, Jonah, thank you. So like – so that's the exact idea. And so I think, you know, I'm not sure if you want to build these outside every U.S. city, but, you know, I'd much rather build this under Yucca Mountain than a big, basically, swimming pool of radioactive hideousness. And so I kind of dig it. And this is why I think we should at least build pilot reactors and try it out. And there's something nifty about being able to do that. And the efficiency – so a typical power – it's hard to underemphasize how different these reactors are to the earlier generation. A typical reactor right now, the water-cooled, water-moderated reactor, gives up 3 to 5% of the uranium or plutonium in the fuel rods before it has to be stopped and reprocessed. These new reactors, the sodium-cooled one, I think the estimates are, when the pilot studies, is 99% efficient. So it's kind of astonishingly better. It's because people thought about it. Rather, you know, the attitude early was, well, we'll figure out, we'll bury it or deal with it. And now the new reactor design is make them passively safe so that if you have all, if there's any screw-ups on the outside, the reactor will just stop and be able to get rid of enough heat that even if it's going full gangbusters and goes to a quick stop because something outside has happened, it can just sit there. And then also to be able to be very efficient using fuel and not produce a lot of waste. And, you know, and again, it should be very clear, you know, 300,000 tons sounds like a tremendous amount. But if you think about the amount of waste generated in just radioactive coal ash from one plant, you're talking about a different. Now, of course, there's a very big difference in the level of radioactivity. But I don't know. Even with all of this and me being kind of impressed with the physics and the engineering with these new designs, I'm still really ambivalent about nuclear power as sort of a primary power source. I'm definitely a fan of, like, putting a lot of aggressive work into wind and geothermal and solar. But I have a feeling, looking at the number of people on the planet and how much power we use, that nuclear is going to have to be in the mix.
I want it to happen just so I don't have to hear the term green-collar jobs anymore.
Oh, my God.
Tired of it.
Biofuels. Biofuels, I'm too irate about biofuels to even give a coherent takedown on it.
Next week
on Dear Science. it's why your cornflakes are more expensive. So this is as good a place of any to stop. We're deeply ambivalent, which is how you know this is a scientific podcast. No conclusions, no real solutions, but begging for more grant money. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much, Jonah, for joining
us. No problem. Thank you for
Big Little Dipper Dipper. Send your science questions to Dear Science at The Stranger. Catch me out on the slog or my own blog, dearscience.org. And thank you for listening.